So this is the fourth talk in a series on anatta, self and no self. And I'd like to title it with a phrase from Winnie the Pooh. It says, the more Pooh looked, the more Piglet wasn't there. The more Pooh looked, the more Piglet wasn't there. But there's also another little story from Winnie the Pooh, which is kind of the opposite, and you need both of them together. And this story, Piglet was busy digging a small hole in the ground outside his house. "Hello, Piglet," said Pooh. "Hello, Pooh," said Piglet, giving a jump of surprise. "I knew it was you." "So did I," said Pooh. So we're between the two stories. We know it's me. And the more we look, maybe we can't find ourselves. But I want to start with a kind of philosophical question. And in a way, we talked about it already, but I'd like to just go over it again. The question is, what's wrong with the self? Isn't it part of nature, given by God, like everything else? What's wrong with the self? Why is it a problem? I think the answer is that there isn't anything wrong with the self. What's wrong is what we do with it. We give it such central power over everything in our life. We serve it like a slave. Our whole life seems service endlessly to this self. We work for it from all our life. We get jobs. We want security. We want to keep it comfortable. We want to keep it beautiful. We want to keep it safe. We want to keep it healthy. And it starts off as a mechanism for protecting the body, like all beings, ahamkara, the eye-making that protects the body. And it ends up just protecting itself. And actually, it's the worst protection in a way. Because if you think about all the big disasters that have happened between human beings, all the wars, all the conflicts, they're almost always about self against a self. They're not about protecting the body. If you protect the body, you just make sure you have food and water. There's no problem. There's very little wars about food and water. They're all, look at Syria. It's about who's in the government, who's not in the government, who has power. Look at the First World War, which to me is a devastating war. I have a lot of interest in it. Perhaps the most terrible war from the point of view of the soldiers that had ever been fought, with gas and millions of soldiers dying. And it was fought because of honor. That's all. Because of honor. Who is more honor, status? So actually, the self is very unhelpful in protecting us. And ends up giving us more vulnerability than if we didn't have one. And it's also the source of so much fear that we're really afraid. And look at the story, my story this morning of the fear of public speaking. It's a classic fear of the self. It's not the body that's afraid. The self is afraid. Once Christopher mentioned that he saw a survey, University of Harvard survey of the American people, asking them, what are they afraid of most? And it turned out that public speaking Pahad Kahal was the number one fear, and number two or number three was a nuclear catastrophe that wipes out most of the world. So people are more afraid of the death of the ego than they are afraid of the death of the whole population, including themselves. So the problem isn't the self. The problem is the way that we, through habits of karma, conditioning, and the way we use our mind, heart, and soul, puts the self right up front here, and we filter the world through the self. And if we look at it a little carefully, actually, when the self is less dominant, we actually feel better. We feel worse when we are most afraid and most protecting ourselves and most worried about what will happen or what did happen or who I must be or who I will not be or whether I want to go to university or get married or divorced. That's when the self gets big time. And that's when we feel most upset and worried and unhappy. And if you ask yourself, everyone says, I want to return to myself. I want to go back to myself. I want to return to myself. And if you look at the kind of conditions that people choose to go back to themselves, it's walking up in the mountains of the Alps. It's going on holiday and swimming under the sea. It's having time off. It's just relaxing and being nobody. And at that time, people say, ah, I've gone back to myself. Which really means that, when you take yourself much lightly, you feel more yourself and you feel more happy with yourself. So it really shows, I mean, here's proof that the self as a runaway kind of master of everything is quite toxic to us. And, you know, can think of where it moves into addiction, into habitual behaviors, into stress, into victim mind. We had for a couple of years a retreat with Germans and Israelis, which I led, one in Berlin and the other one in Israel in Kliel, and it was really around the narrative of the Holocaust, and it was really trying, in a sense, to deconstruct the Holocaust narrative. But first of all, we had to actually show how this narrative was controlling us from inside, and we didn't even know it. And we were talking about it as the elephant in the room, which everyone was sort of dancing around and behaving because of it, but nobody addressing it, what it is in the actual consciousness. And the Jewish-Israeli-Jewish narrative of victim comes from it. Is one of those that causes so much pain. But when it's exposed and dissolved, we can feel a lot freer and lighter. And the interesting thing in this retreat was every time when the Israelis understood that the Germans have a similar Holocaust narrative, which is just as painful, but opposite. Their narrative is not the victim, but I don't know what I did. My parents did something terrible. Something happened there. They don't talk about it at home. I feel very bad. It takes away my joy of life. Two narratives coming, but both of them, the elephant in the room, needs to be exposed as a thing that dominates self, that sits in the subconscious and steals our joy. The Buddha said the self is a bit like a dog running around and around a stick, which it's tied to a stick, and it runs round and round. and the stick is the self, and we run round and round this thing. And in a spiritual practice, it tells us something, that one way to really move out of the dominance of self is actually relaxation. Is taking things more easily. Because the opposite of relaxation, namely achievement or pushing or fear, is actually increasing the self. To be in a spiritual path with less self, it's much more about letting go. It's much more about relaxing. It's much more about dropping things. And I remember Tokni Rinpoche, when he was here, he was talking about this quite a lot, that when you relax, you can just drop the self more easily. And I invite you to try it. When you're struggling here, sitting here for another 10 minutes, and then just relax. And just let go. And just drop the need to be somebody or to do something or to get anywhere or to change anything or to fix something. And just see what happens. And just see how something is let go of, something dissolves. Our deep okayness, the joy, the ease, it helps us to go beyond the self. At one time in my long journey in the Dharma, I felt I was on the edge of an abyss, Tahom, and I really wanted to jump off, and I couldn't. It was too scary. I felt it was right there, and I couldn't jump. And a teacher and a friend talked to him about it, and he said, well, just be joyful. Joy will reduce the fear, and then there's no problem. So realize that joy is a power that dissolves fear and uncertainty, dissolves the fear of the unknown, of what I might be like with no self. It's fear. What I might be like with less self. Fear. What might happen to me if I don't know myself so well? It's scary. What will I be like if I don't know myself as I know myself now? Scary. Of course, after all of that, I realized the whole thing was completely another construction. There's no abyss, and there's nowhere to jump, and there's no tehom, and took me a while to realize that. But here is, by the way, a break point between psychology and spiritual practice. Psychology. I'm sorry, psychologists here, if I'm simplifying everything, but there's a lot we can talk about here. But I just allow me to be just oversimple right now. That psychology tends to stop at the sense of okayness. That if you're reach an okayness, you don't really need to sit opposite the psychologist. I know there's exceptions, and I know psychology actually does go further into archetypes and into many, many different areas. But generally, the agenda of psychology is to help you with okayness. I am okay with my life. I'm fitting with my life. My life is fitting with me. I'm functioning well and basically fine. That's the starting point of the spiritual journey. And so that okayness place is where the two begins to split. And just allowing that in you as a power that will allow you to go beyond the self. This sense of okayness. It's the first power I also mentioned on the second day of trust, one of the five powers. But yes, it can be scary. This spiritual business is not necessarily all a path of roses. If you all want to leave the retreat now, please do. We'll give you buses to take you back to Tel Aviv. But there is the dark night of the soul. There is the difficulty we might face. There is a risk that if we don't do things in harmony, if we take the spiritual journey too intensively, too crazily, then the non-self might happen too fast, and it's not healthy. It's got to be done in a steady way, feeling the okayness, and feeling it's all right to have a little less self, and feeling the joy of it, of being less full of me, and more full of the world, full of life. So we just to be aware that when we talk about self, there is certain minefields or kind of sadem mokshim. I have a friend. Mostly these problems come dafka actually in the world of psychiatry, and not so much in the world of spiritual practice. But it does happen occasionally in spiritual practice when things get too intense and you're pushing too hard. And it has happened. And I have a friend who, many, many years ago, who took crazy overdose of LSD, and he entered a period of 2 years of the most scary depersonalization. He just died. And he died, his self died. And he just couldn't function. And he would just be walking all day and night in the streets, in Wales this was, in Cardiff. And he would sit down and he'd feel himself disappearing into the chair, going into the house below him. Flat below him, he would walk, and he would walk through, feel himself walking through walls, and there was no boundary, and everything, he was in the chairs, and in the ceiling, looking at himself, and he just was going crazy. But actually he went to Goenka, and Goenka really helped him, and said, Goenka, of course, the first reaction to this total psychiatric disaster was to laugh. As Goenka, I don't know if any of you know Goenka, but I've been sitting with him, but he's got a great laugh. So he burst out laughing, and then he said very simply, meditate on sensations, but never let the sensations go out of the boundary of your body. In other words, restore again this fiction or this mental habit called boundary of the body. And he did it, and in 10 days he was way, way better. And actually he got from this experience amazing psychic powers, and he's still a friend of mine. So we don't need a theory that we have to get rid of anything. We don't need a theory that we have to fight the self. We need an understanding that based on our natural okayness, we have to see the self in all its glory as it comes, as it goes, as it changes. We have to be able to watch the self in its dance. As we do that, we get free of it, or freer. It becomes less dominant. We begin to feel at home in this shape that karma has created for us. This shape is this one here. Or this one, or this one, or this one. It's a shape, like a tree. A tree is a shape. The tree outside here doesn't say, oh, I must be more of a tree, or more me, or less me. Or the tree is just a tree. It has its shape. It's developed through conditions, the water, the air, the sun, the earth, and makes a shape. And we can feel the same. No problem. It's a shape that we have. We have a form. The body has a form. We have memories. We have thoughts. We have all that complex that makes a human being. And it's okay. And the self is not that interesting. And that's the direction of our practice. That to make the self less interesting is anatta. Rather than fight it. And we look at the self by examining our experience. Because there is no experience without an experiencer. And when there is no experiencer, then you can say there really is no experience either. And there are spiritual landscape or spiritual practice and spiritual understanding, wisdom, in which really there is no experience. You're beyond experience. The non-dual unitive states are really not an experience. They're rather beyond experience, and there's no experiencer and an experienced object there. But we're going to talk about that later, not today. But for now, look at the experience, because in every experience there is an experiencer. There is someone there that knows what's going on. I know I exist. I am hearing the air conditioning. Needs me, a subject, to hear an object. Let's look at that. What is knowing? What is the knower? I wonder how many of you have worked on that, thought about it in meditation, for example. Just the knower. Because in the basic classic meditation instruction, we are usually talking about the object, the breath, the body, a thought. And I mentioned separation of the oil and the water, the awareness separating from identification with object. But what is the oil? It's the knower. It's the knowing. It's the subject that knows. Worth looking at. What is the knowing and the knower? Separate from the object. What is the witness that knows? What belongs to me? What is the arising of the subject as the center of experience? How is that feeling? Who is looking right now? And you're looking at me. Who is looking? Now, some of that really needs, it's a lifelong story. It is not just an instant thing, which is, if I do my meditation right, it'll all become absolutely clear. This is a life story of exploring, questioning, contemplation. And here, we need the questions as well. We need to listen, like you're listening to the talk. It's arising thoughts and ideas and a vision maybe of practice which you haven't thought about. That's fine. It needs reading, it needs questioning, it needs contemplation. It's a sort of thing that we do in the street as well as on retreat. It's a sort of thing that I mentioned before with the struggle with my father when I asked him, is his finger Jewish? Where am I Jewish? It's that child that says, where am I? One of my daughters at the age of 6 was standing in front of the mirror and she said, well, I see a nose and I see hair and I see some ears and I see some hands, but where is Tamarin? I remember her very young, 6 years old. Where is me? I see all these parts. And this contemplation is really useful. One of the most important books written since the time of the Buddha is written by Nagarjuna. And Nagarjuna was basically a Buddhist philosopher, a practitioner, and regarded as awakened. But his process was quite analytic. He was trying to show that there cannot be a self as an entity by just examining reality using thought. Using thought and a bit more than thought. Questions that vibrate. Questions that disturb. Questions that don't have a clear answer. In a way, they're questions that make the ground fall away from us, that will leave us no ground. That's the kind of questions. But still quite analytic. And he asked, for example, am I the same as all the pieces that make me up, like Tamarin in front of the mirror? Am I the same as all the pieces? Well, if I'm the same as all the bits, the cells, the fingers, the hands, the water in the body, the carbon, nitrogen, khankan, am I all these? Well, if I am, then I'm many selves. Each one is a self if I'm the same as them. But am I different from them? But if I'm different from all the pieces that make up me, then they would have no effect on me. So my me wouldn't have any. Nothing would happen. I wouldn't be there with any of them. The Nagarjuna's book is translated. Main book is translated to Hebrew, and it's well worth having a look at. What's the title in Hebrew? Do you remember? Shirat Ha'emtza. And let me just quote, just give you a flavor. Shirat Shoresh Ha'emtza. It's there are many poems, each one of which is full of these kind of radical questions that collapse our basic assumptions of reality. And there's one poem called Self, which I want to read part of it. If mind and matter was me, I would come and go like them. But if I was something else, they would say nothing about me. What is mine if there is no me? Where self-centeredness eased, I wouldn't think of me and mine. There would be no one there to think then. Buddhas do speak of self and also teach no self and also say there's nothing which is either self or not. When things dissolve, there's nothing left to say. The unborn and the unceasing, unstopping, are already free. The Buddha said, it's real, and it's unreal. And it's both real and unreal. And it's neither one nor the other. So we're in a the question that we ask and contemplate can be in the area of ownership of what about the pieces that make us up, about control. How much do I really control? Do I control my breath? Do I own when I go to the hair to have a haircut? Do I cry when the hairdresser sweeps my hair into the rubbish bin? Me. You're throwing me away. Stop. We decide that's not me. When did we decide that? It needs contemplation, it needs reflection, it needs looking, it needs questioning. Again and again, right from the very beginning of the Buddha's teaching, in the very first suttas, after his awakening, he kept persuading people and telling people that arrived, look, if everything is passing by, it's your experience to see that you see that nothing is stable, that everything passes and moves all the time. And if everything is passing, then there cannot be a thing called me that doesn't change. Everything is changing, so how can there be a me? And more than that, if the me seems to be so painful, how is it that we want it? How can there be a me if it's all so painful? We can get stuck. And one of the places to get stuck, and the Buddha was warning us about this, is in the world of speculation, of parshanuyot, of thinking about. And that's really, the self issue is really attractive place to get stuck on thinking about. And in one of the early suttas, and the Buddha said, this is how people pay attention without wisdom. Was I in the past? Or was I not in the past? What was I in the past? How was I in the past? And having been what before, what did I become in the past? Shall I be in the future? Like my year? Will I be in the future? Shall I not be in the future? What shall I be in the future? How shall I be in the future? And having been what in the past, what shall I become in the future? Or else they were knotted, perplexed around the present. Am I? Or am I not? Like Shakespeare, to be or not to be. What am I? How am I? Who am I? Where has this being come from? Where will it go? When you attend unwisely in this way, one of six views arises. The view, self exists for me, arises as true and established. Or the view, no self exists for me, arises as true and established. Or the view, I see self with self, arises as true and established. Or the view, I see not self with self, arises as true and established. Or the view, I see self with not self, I perceive self with not self. Or else they have some view like, it is this self of mine that speaks and feels and experiences here and there the results of good and bad actions. And this self of mine is permanent, eternal, not subject to change, and it will keep going as long as eternity. I think he's having a kick here at the Indian concept of Atman. which is the Sanskrit of atta. These views, monks, are called the thicket of views. Thicket is a kind of, what's the word in Hebrew? Thicket of bushes.
Svach.
Svach. The thicket of views, a wilderness of views, a twisted place of views, vacillation, nadned, wobbling place of views, tying views. Tied by these views, ordinary person is not free from birth, aging, and death, pain, grief, and despair, and suffering. So we have to be careful not just to kind of be in the world of views about self. But again, if we are close and intimate to the self as it arises, without thinking about it, without views, with a sense that we're watching the dance of self, and the dance of the subject, and the dance of the knower, we're in the right place. And also the questions, when we question, questions are important here. Fundamental question in half of the Buddhist world is, who am I? If you go to Korean Zen monasteries, if you go to all kinds of Dharma centers, one of the questions floating around will be, who am I, who am I, who am I? In the Tibetan practice, it's often combined with states of energy that shape the mind. And we have sometimes Dzogchen retreats here in Israel. And one of the things that happen is the shout, where we basically shout, bah! At that moment, when the shout happens, bah! Now look at yourself. There's a gap in the thinking. And in that gap, look at yourself. So sometimes using the help of energetic and mind-changing practice, and at those moments, ask the question, who am I now? Those of you who love, as I do, the Advaita teachers like Ramana Maharshi and their practice, and I've been many times to the ashram in Tiru, and Ramana Maharshi is one of the greatest died sages of the 20th century. And he basically said, who am I, is the fundamental question. Just sit with it. Just let it work. Let it work as a kind of a virus that goes through the whole system and makes everything unstable and not solid. It's a question. Just stay with it. It undoes mental fixation. It takes to pieces our mental structures. The sense of meeting the witness, who am I? Because when we meet the witness, when we meet the knower, the subject, actually, when we get close to this knower, we get close to a quality which is non-personal. It takes time. And if we get close to the witness, we get close to the sense of being alive. When we get close to being alive, the sense of being alive, we get close to awareness. We call it awareness. And awareness is impersonal. It doesn't have a label on it, me. And our meditation can be there. We can see and look at the arising of selfing, the arising of the me, the knower, the witness, and see how it changes and moves and sometimes dissolves. It's one of the rules of spiritual practice. The more you look at something, the more it fades away. It's just the way things are. And the reason neurologists can explain this, that the brain depends on differences. We're only knowing things because they're different from each other. So we know one thing from another because they're different, they have a boundary, they're separate. The minute we look at something intensely, it tends to fade away. If right now you're experiencing the touch of your hands, which are touching your legs or each other or touching a cushion or something. If you just experience the touch of your hands now and just stay there, you might sense that it's not sure what it is that you're feeling. And you can't exactly describe it. And it's not a real thing anymore. It's something a bit mysterious. Life, energy, and touch. When we look at things, they tend to vanish. And so when we look at the self, it tends to vanish. It wasn't there in the first place. Or it wasn't there as a thing, shall we say, in the first place. And that's the title of the talk, by the way. The more Pooh looked, the more Piglet wasn't there. It's exactly the title. The more we look, the more we see that what we thought was a thing isn't there as a thing that is independent and solid and existing on its own. The interesting thing about the self as from our spiritual journey is that as it's the biggest sankhara, and sankhara is construction. So this is a construction, and this is a hand is a construction. But the self seems to be everywhere. In everything we do, behind everything that we experience, the self seems covering all our experience, everywhere. Therefore, if we can look straight at the self and see how it is less dominant and less real, its totality helps us to experience totality. I don't know whether you understand what I'm saying, but the fact that it is so total means that if we are engaged with the self, we are engaged with totality, with everything. And that's why it's so important. It leads us directly to the view of life rather than the view of me. Because it's so dominant, but also not so easy. But if we can engage with the self, we find that that's the place where we can engage with the totality of things, with everything. It's as if the self has two faces. One face is pointing to ordinary reality, and the other face is pointing to the ultimate, amukhlat, the totality, the awakened state. So if we are busy with the two faces of self, it'll help us have access to the awakened state through working with self, because self is everywhere. But the good news is that a little bit of this goes quite a long way. We don't have to kind of feel it's all or nothing. And I've got to sit here and go to a monastery 10 years, and only then will I begin to loosen the ties of self and see and be part of the totality of oneness. Because even some sense of lightness around the self by watching its dance already frees us, already gives us more relief, already gives us less fear and protection, less busyness trying to be comfortable. We don't take our stories so seriously, like in the example of the retreat and the Holocaust. What a relief there was at the end of a retreat, 5 days. Israelis and Germans, we were in ecstasy. Just because of the lightness that came from something heavy that we didn't realize was dominating at the inner world, and as soon as we could see it with lightness, there was such sense of freedom and sense of lightness. So we may be afraid a bit to let go of habits, to let go of the known self, let go of the known me. But it's always, when it happens, it's always a huge relief. I have never met anybody that said, I want to go back into my heavy, dominant, controlling self. I want to go back. I want it back again. It may be a little difficult to let go, but it's always a great relief. And I want to finish with two things. One is a small quote, one of my favorite quotes from Chesterton, who said, "Why do angels fly? Because they take themselves more lightly." I think that's, for us, a good message. We take ourselves more lightly. And I want to quote one of my favorite teachers, authors that I've been connecting with for a very long time, Krishnamurti, because he's got such beautiful language. And I just want to read to you what he writes about that experience of beyond the self and how that expresses the endlessness, the totality, and how he moves beyond the self into the totality of existence. I should say here that Krishnamurti doesn't use the word I, he uses the word you, but he means himself. And I'm going to take the liberty, because it make it easier for you, to put the word back to I. To wherever he says you, I'm going to say I, meaning himself. "And as the sun came up over the horizon in a cloudless sky, it made a golden path. And it was extraordinary to see that light filling the earth and every leaf and blade of grass. As I watched, a great stillness came into me. The brain itself became very quiet, without any reaction, without a movement. And it was strange to feel this immense stillness. Feel isn't the word. The quality of that silence, that stillness, is not felt by the brain. It is beyond the brain. The brain can conceive, formulate, or make a design for the future. But this stillness is beyond its range, beyond all imagination, beyond all desire. I am so still that my body becomes completely part of the earth, part of everything that is still. And as the slight breeze came from the hills, stirring the leaves, this stillness, this extraordinary quality of silence, was not disturbed. And as I watched the sea, so very still, I really became part of everything. I was everything. I was the light and the beauty of love. Again, to say I was part of everything is also wrong. The word I is not adequate, because I really wasn't there. I didn't exist. There was only that stillness, the beauty.
the extraordinary sense of love. The words you and I separate things. This division in this strange silence and stillness doesn't exist. And as I watched out of the window, space and time seemed to have come to an end. And the space that divides had no reality. That leaf and that eucalyptus and the blue shining water were not different from me. So that's it for a couple of minutes.